Hey, podcast listeners, before we get started, I still need your help. Even if you've left a review in the past, if it has not been in the last month, then go to the lower right-hand corner of your iPhone screen where those little dots are. Click on those little dots, then click Go to Show. Go to Show will take you to all the episodes or a majority of the episodes on Questioning Medicine that have been posted. Scroll down to the bottom and leave a 5-star review. You don't have to leave any comments if you don't want to. Just click the 5 stars and hit Submit. It really does help a bunch of other listeners start to question medicine, which I think at a time when so much bad literature is being published, so much misinformation is being pushed to the public, we need to all question medicine a little bit more. And with that, let's get on to the show. Welcome back to Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about, and we are going to cover some articles. Today is going to be, hopefully, a quick hit on a bunch of articles. Usually, there are articles out there, and this is going to be the majority of them today, in which the information is not so overly flawed that I feel like I need to talk about it for 6 years straight or 220 minutes in one consecutive podcast. I can just hit on the high points of the articles, hit on the important information that you need to know for your practice tomorrow, and then move on to the next article. So without any further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, Andrew Bilt, Questioning Medicine, 2020. Let's do this thing. First article we're going to jump into. Well, let me backtrack and just tell you, Henry Ford once said, failure is simply the opportunity to begin again, this time more intelligently. And that must be in the back of your mind when I tell you about this article titled Designed to Fail, The Future of Primary Care. This was published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Here we know that the access to primary care has been shown to improve patient outcomes and lower the cost. Now, I will say that the improved patient outcomes part is debated in the medical literature because the outcomes are surrogate markers. The outcomes that they refer to as being quote-unquote improved are usually not mortality. They are things like lower lipid levels or lower A1Cs, but they do improve some outcomes, and there is no doubt that it lowers the cost. Because if a primary care provider can take care of your diabetes without you having to go to an endocrinologist and take care of your heart failure medication or your blood pressure medication without you having to go to a cardiologist, then take care of or manage and recheck on your chronic kidney disease without you having to go to a nephrologist, and then also address some of your obesity problems because you are eating too much without having to send you to a nutritionalist, if the list goes on and on and on forever. And if a primary care provider, one provider even can bill a level 5 instead of, I don't know, 6 different providers all billing a level 3, 4, or 5, that saves money. It is just simple mathematics, which is why I'm a fan that if you're going to address multiple conditions in high stages of illness or severity, you should be able to bill, I don't know, a level 5 for a cardiologist. I don't care that you're a primary care physician. Level 5 for them. Level 5 for endocrinology. Level 5 for each system that you address, not just for the visit. But that is neither here nor there. That's just the way I would do it if I ran the world. And since I don't, let's get back to the article at hand. The authors in this paper analyzed in 2019 the in-basket or the EMR in-basket activity that we all get at the University of Michigan to determine the average weekly activity inside the EMR. When they strictly looked at the numbers, a full-time primary care faculty member at the University of Michigan had a total of 390 in-basket tasks per week, or 17,500 in-basket tasks per year. And when they surveyed the clinicians and they said, hey, listen, you have a bunch of in-basket activities, so we're going to add to your in-basket activities and actually now give you an in-basket survey. How much time do you think, to the nearest minute, that you spend on in-basket tasks? And the median time spent was 20 hours per week. And many of these tasks that they get, these incoming lab works and these incoming prior authorizations, they all require something like a phone call. They require a referral to another specialist. They require follow-up lab work. They require an inpatient office visit. They require sending an email back to the patient. They all require something, and all of these requirements are unpaid time for the primary care provider. Basically, in today's current system, the primary care provider has a full-time job seeing patients and then has another part-time job, or 20 hours a week, in which they're answering inbox messages and they're not getting paid for it. It's a full-time job that you get paid for with that part-time job that you get no paid for. And we often wonder, why? Why is no one going into primary care anymore? Maybe the answer is because they're smart. Henry Ford once said, failure is simply the opportunity to begin again, this time more intelligently. And I don't think there is any more clear article that shows primary care in its current setup is failing. We should begin again, but this time more intelligently. And on to the next article. I have said many times that I love an article that answers a simple question. It asks a simple question, it answers a simple question, and then you know the information that you need and you can just move on with your day. How fantastic. Well, it is no more clearly seen than in this article titled, Are We Overstating the Risk of Priapism with Oral Phosphodiesterase Type 5 Inhibitors in the Journal of Sexual Medicine. Now, oral phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors is a mouthful. So for the rest of this article, I'm just going to call it Viagra. I don't get any money from Viagra. I don't have a preference Viagra over Cialis, over any of the other medications. I really don't care what you write for it. None of these really matter to me. So if I say Viagra, if I say Cialis, if I say any other drug, it's just because it's a lot easier for me to say than oral phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors. Whew. So the information in this article is that Viagra and Cialis are famous for the end of the commercials saying, you need to consult a doctor or go to the emergency room right away if you have an erection lasting longer than 4 hours. And if it's lasting longer than 4 hours, it's probably going to hurt really bad. And you should probably call your neighbor right away, or call 911 or call someone else, because we are not going to be held responsible. So please don't sue us. Please, please, please. And blah, 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 blah. You get the point. Well, in this study, they looked to answer the question, how often does that whole situation actually occur? They evaluated all cases of priapism reported to the FDA since 1998, which happens to be when Viagra hit the market, and they were able to identify a total of 411 cases due to Viagra or Cialis or any of the phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors. Now, it is hard, in fact, it's really incredibly hard, to get a precise number on the number of Viagra and Cialis prescriptions that have been written over the course of time, because there's just no good way to track that, or at least no good way that I was able to find in any of my research to track that. But I can tell you, in the first year and a half of marketing in the United States, there were more than 15.6 million prescriptions of Viagra that had been filled. So even if there was not another script of Viagra or Cialis written for, and we just went based on the numbers of the very first year and a half, and we assume that each prescription was for only 3 pills, and that there were 0 refills on any of those that were then followed up later, then the rate of priapism would be 411 cases per 46.8 million pills, which in percent terms comes out to 0.0008%. Basically nothing. And that is just in the first year the scripts came out. And remember, we looked at all cases, 411 cases, since 1998, but we only looked at the prescriptions from 1998 to basically just short of 2000. So we're missing all these other scripts. So the numbers are absolutely 100%, I can guarantee you, even lower than 0.0008%. I think the authors nailed it on the head when they said, although oral phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors do induce priapism, it appears less common than once suspected, when consulting patients, this should be considered. What they're trying to say in politically correct terms is, yeah, this should definitely be considered. We should all back away a little bit because, like the media, we as providers are likely over-exaggerating the true risk of what is going on. And with that, let's move on to the next article. And Dean Martin once said, everybody loves somebody sometime, but it appears in medicine, everybody wants to treat subclinical hypothyroidism sometime. And this is clearly seen in this JAMA article titled Effects of Levothyroxine on Left Ventricular Ejection Fraction in Patients with Subclinical Hypothyroidism and Acute Myocardial Infarction, a Randomized Clinical Trial, where they, the author, sought to find if levothyroxine or Synthroid treatment improved the left ventricular function in patients with subclinical hypothyroidism presenting with acute myocardial infarction. You might remember back to last year, one of the articles that I thought was Article of the Year, BMJ Rapid Review Recommendation, in which they said, do not treat subclinical hypothyroidism unless you have a patient less than 30 years old, unless your patient is pregnant or trying to get pregnant, or unless the TSH is greater than 20. Those were the only three times in which you could then treat subclinical hypothyroidism. But everybody wants to treat subclinical hypothyroidism sometimes. So the authors in this double-blind randomized clinical trial took 95 participants with subclinical hypothyroidism and acute myocardial infarction, and they treated them with either levothyroxine or placebo. The levothyroxine treatment group started at 25 and titrated up to aim for a TSH level between 0.4 and 2.5, basically normal or low end of normal for the TSH scale. And after 52 weeks, the authors nailed it when they say treatment with levothyroxine compared with placebo did not significantly improve left ventricular ejection fraction after 52 weeks. I don't even think I can say it any better than that. Everybody wants to treat subclinical hypothyroidism, but we shouldn't. Not sometime, not really anytime, unless they have a TSH greater than 20, they are less than 30 years old, or they are pregnant and trying to be pregnant. Just stick to the guidelines. Now, William Shakespeare once said, don't trust the person who has broken faith once. But I think what he meant to say was, don't trust a medical journal abstract, which is clearly seen in this paper titled Sodium Glucose Cotransporter 2 Inhibitors and the Risk for Diabetic Ketoacidosis, a Multicenter Cohort Study. In the abstract of this study, if you only read the abstract, in the conclusion they will say SGLT2 inhibitors were associated with an almost threefold increased risk for DKA, with molecule-specific analysis suggesting a class effect. Whew, that sounds really bad. That sounds like, look at this, threefold increase of DKA with SGLT2 inhibitors, and it doesn't even matter which one I write for, they're all going to do it. It's a class effect. Well, in this study, they looked at the electronic healthcare database from 7 Canadian provinces and the United Kingdom and found a total of over 400,000 patients on either DDP4 or SGLT2 inhibitors. The mean follow-up was almost right around 1 year, and during this time, out of all of those people, there were only 521 cases of DKA. 521 cases out of 400,000 patients. And if you just go by the numbers, then the risk for DKA was 2 per 1,000 for the SGLT2 inhibitors and 0.75 per 1,000 people for the DDP4 inhibitors. That is very close to a threefold increase, and it is scary, especially when you say there's a threefold increase of DKA. Definitely don't use SGLT2 inhibitors. But the fact that no DDP4 inhibitor has ever, never gonna get it, shown to be beneficial for the outcomes that I or my patients care about, like major adverse cardiovascular events and chronic kidney disease, I think I and all my patients will take their chances when it comes to 2 per 1,000 people years. I would say it like this. Mr. Jones, I can give you a medication that will put you in a hospital once every 500 years, but out of every 20 to 50 people that take it it will prevent at least one heart attack or one death or one renal failure or one stroke, one hard outcome that you might care about. Or I can give you a drug that will only put you in the hospital for DKA once every 1,000 years, but has never ever been shown to do any of the heart attack strokes. It's never been shown to prevent anything at all. What would you like to do? This is obviously a straw man argument and a terrible comparable arm and a gentle and continued reminder to always question medicine and don't trust the abstract. It is simply not good enough. And last but certainly not least, this has been a long time coming, but a quick update, a quick recommendation, and a quick little hard-hitting fact that we all need to know about. It was in JAMA 2020 titled The USPSTF Screening for Hepatitis C Virus Infection in Adolescents and Adults. This was the USPSTF recommendation for screening for hepatitis C, and these recommendations replace the previous 2013 USPSTF recommendation of screening for adults born between 1945 and 1965. In this 2020 update, the USPSTF found that there was adequate evidence for hepatitis C virus screening, and although there is no direct evidence on the benefit of screening for hepatitis C virus infection on patient-oriented outcomes, there is convincing evidence that treatment results in a high proportion, 95 to 99% of adults, who maintain a sustained response to treatment, with a strong association between this sustained response and improved health outcomes. The task force also recommends screening for hepatitis C in all pregnant women. Couple important things here. I hate the yearly physical exam. I think it is terrible. It is worthless. It is awful. But now, if you're going to do it, you probably should make sure that you are A, screening for HIV based on USPSTF, B, screening for hepatitis C based on USPSTF. And although the authors here and the Cochrane Review both clearly state that, listen, we don't have enough information to say that a low viral load or clearing of the viral load actually does what you guys think that it does. I mean, we know that having no Hep C viruses probably is a good thing. We don't have the evidence that says that it actually improves mortality, that it makes you live any longer. It's just a surrogate marker for those things. I will say, in the people that I have seen treated for this, they feel a lot better. And even if it's just the personal, hey, I feel a lot better, that's at least something. My final tidbit about this recommendation is this recommendation replaces the 2013 recommendation, which did say only screen individuals that were born between 1945 and 1965. And to me, that was something I hated on the board exams, because I'd have to remember this. Is it 1945 to 65? Is it 45 to, is it 75? No, now it's everyone. Everyone gets screening for hepatitis C. This is a big change, not only for our patients, but for the board exam. And with that, let's wrap up this podcast as I've wrapped up every one before it. Let's review the articles we talked about today. Primary care needs a change. I don't know what that change is. I don't have the answer for it, but it needs a change because providers are indeed working way too hard on tasks in their in-basket, on their EMR in-basket that they're not getting paid for. In the Journal of Sexual Medicine, it said Viagra does cause priapism, but not nearly as often as you would think. So we are likely, almost certainly, overemphasizing this side effect when we're writing for any of the Cialis, Viagra medications that are out there. And if you want to treat subclinical hypothyroidism, well, then you should not do it to improve the left ventricular ejection fraction in patients after an acute myocardial infarction, because it doesn't beat placebo. Sometimes we always need a reminder to not just read the abstract, and that is clearly seen in this paper, which says there's triple the rate of DKA if you use an SGLT2 inhibitor. What they're failing to mention is that the SGLT2 inhibitors actually prevent or actually reduce the patient-oriented outcomes that I care about. So for me and my patients, I'm going to continue to prescribe them, especially over DDP4 inhibitor. It is not even a close call. And last but not least, the USPSTF has now come out and said everyone, yes, everyone, needs to be screened for hepatitis C. And everyone also includes all pregnant women. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every single one before it. Wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.